Welcome to the 15th episode of A Change is a Chance. My name is Brian Lowe, and it's my goal to educate as many people as possible by interviewing experts who can teach us how to make a difference. This episode is the second part of the two-part interview with Ms. Stephanie Lim and Mr. Martin Richardson of Hip Hop for Change, a nonprofit that is devoted to producing authentic hip-hop that empowers budding activists while teaching them how to unlearn and relearn the history of the world. If you haven't seen the first one, please check that out. Today, I want to explore the topic of Afro-Asian solidarity. I am aware that there is anti-Black and anti-Asian sentiment within the two communities, and I believe we need to change this as quickly as possible. Mostly because I've always been taught that different ethnic groups must work together against white supremacy. My parents were always big on teaching me what wasn't taught in our history books. Then I heard about the term Afro-Asian solidarity through Hip Hop for Change, and I felt so connected to it. And I later learned that it's something that has always existed but isn't talked about that much, which is why I would like to talk with you guys and bring it to the forefront. So, first of all, the fight for social justice has reached a new level of prominence in the last year and a half. I hate to say this because systemic racism has always been with us, but after the higher profile murders of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, and the countless others have made it more urgent, the entire world at least acknowledges that white supremacy exists. So I want to talk about your own experiences in last year's BLM demonstrations. What are some of Hip Hop for Change's events, and how have you seen the demographics of supporters change?
Oh boy. I'll speak to just my own experience, and then Stephanie, you can piggyback off that to kind of talk about the inception of our Afro-Asian Solidarity Program. But in the midst of the Black Lives Matter protest and rallies last year during the summertime, what we found is kind of a new wave of support from the community in terms of the work that we do, in terms of funding. So it was kind of bittersweet because we've been around for 8 years, and it's only now that people just start seemingly wanting to care a lot about Black people and Black causes, right? So you know, better late than never, nonetheless, ultimately. But it just kind of does ring bittersweet in that sense, where we've been doing the work historically and sincerely. But because of the recent incidences of murder and the resistance movement that we've been seeing from the Black and Brown communities, we've been getting a lot of support. Further to that, I will say that we've also been able to partner with a lot of organizations that we may not have been aware of or have been in conversations with. And I think that that's amazing because, like Malcolm X said, it's not that we are outnumbered, we are out-organized, right? We are fighting systematic oppression. White supremacy in and of itself is in fact a system, and we cannot combat systems by an individual or by the cult of personality. I think it's important for us to recognize that you combat systems with alternative systems, right? That are rooted in a free humanity, that are rooted in a creative spirit, and that you allow people to make the decisions, right? And I think that more people who are inclined to want to live in this world free of strife and free of violence and all of that are going to pick a system that is inclusive of everybody and that is considerate of everybody and allows everybody to have an equitable seat at the table, as opposed to what we have been doing over the last maybe 500 years is, you know, oppression, extermination, genocide, capitalism, running amok to the point where, you know, our planet is suffering. We can continue down that path and we'll be gone off this planet in the next 50 years, or we can try something else. And I think Hip Hop for Change is on the verge or instrumental organization in that trying of something else, right? So that's the kind of way we position ourselves. And we've been very fortunate to have had kind of an awakening in terms of awareness of what we do and the support that we've been getting.
Well, actually, before we continue, I wanted to re-bring up what I was saying earlier about events. I'm going to elaborate. And what were your favorite events out of the many from Hip Hop for Change? Because I would definitely like to know.
I mean, there's so many events that we do. I mean, our flagship events are kind of our Environmental Equity Summit that we do every year, or Women's Empowerment Summit. But now that we've been doing this series of Afro-Asian solidarity events, I think that that's something that's becoming more and more popular and more welcomed. Stephanie, do you want to say anything about it?
I would say that, like, my favorite Hip Hop for Change event are our Women's Empowerment events. But I guess as of recently, I have been really feeling our Afro-Asian solidarity events, not because I'm a part of it, but just because I think that they are very powerful. And I think that, like, you know, we haven't really had spaces that were like exclusively like Black, but like for the Black and Asian communities to come together and heal, especially in the Bay Area. So I feel like what we're doing is really kind of revolutionary, because, like, you know, our communities have lived side by side, especially in the Bay Area and especially in California. We live in so close proximity to each other, but, you know, we're not really opening, we haven't really been opening the dialogue. We haven't really been healing and like unlearning and relearning. So I think that these spaces provide that revolutionary platform for healing. And I think that's amazing. So I would say that and our women's empowerment events. Yeah.
Well, I'll say that my favorite is the Afro-Asian Solidarity panel. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
I learned from one of your online events that Afro-Asian Solidarity started even before the Civil Rights Movement. Can you talk about when it did start and how it really strengthened during the 1960s?
Right. So even before the Civil Rights Movements, we birthed this term, Afro-Asian solidarity. And so that's the term that we use for all of our events, because, you know, this term in itself has so much power, yet it's not being used, but it's such a historical movement. And so we see early forms of Afro-Asian solidarity forming during the Philippines War. So this is right after the Spanish-American War. And there are specifically Black cavaliers that decided that it was a conflict of conscience for them to fight this war in the Philippines when the Philippines had just been colonized. And the people in the Philippines were fighting for their own self-determination, their sovereignty, and their freedom. So who were these Black Americans to be fighting against them when they're fighting the same fight back at home? So that's an early form of Afro-Asian solidarity. And then we have the Cold War. We have the Cold War politics, where the world was divided into, you know, the first world US, and then the second world Soviet Union, and the third world was just everybody else. It was all of the Black and brown people through this diaspora around the world, and that included Latin America, Asia, Africa. That was just lumped into the third world. So, and that's when you have the Bandung movement, the Bandung Conference, which was called the Non-Aligned Movement also. It took place in Bandung, Indonesia, and this was a conference where all of the non-aligned peoples, or the third world peoples, came, and their leaders spoke about colonialism, racism, imperialism, and they talked about, you know, establishing this pact where they would no longer give up their sovereignty to powers like the US or the Soviet Union, and instead try to promote peaceful diplomacy between each other. And so that's where you get the term Afro-Asian solidarity, because the next conference after that was called the Cairo Conference, but it was also called the Afro-Asian Solidarity People's Conference. And so you have that, and then you also have beautiful movements like the Third World Liberation Front that took place in the U.S. Like, you know, this specifically took place in UC Berkeley, but it went around the entire U.S. And so a lot of these students who identified with this Afro-Asian Solidarity Conference or the Third World Liberation, they saw this as a way to fight for ethnic studies, because the American education system had only been teaching us history from the perspective of white supremacy, which it still does, but at least now we have ethnic studies because of those movements. And so that's why Afro-Asian solidarity is so important, because, you know, it's been prevalent throughout history, yet nobody teaches it. And so, especially during the Vietnam War and the civil rights protests, our history books don't show Black and Asian activists fighting alongside each other, when actually the civil rights movement was beautiful because we had all types of people from different cultures and different ethnic groups coming together, like Yuriko Chiyama and Malcolm X. And you have, you know, there's so many examples, and we fought side by side during civil rights movement and during the Vietnam War protests. And Dr. MLK, he was a strong advocate for ending the war in Vietnam, because for the same reason that the cavalry during the Philippines War didn't want to fight people in the Philippines, you know, Black Americans didn't want to fight, they didn't want to fight Vietnamese freedom fighters for that same reason, this conflict of conscience. And every time there's been an immigration act against the Asian American community, Black people have stood up and fought for us on our behalf. So there's a lot of instances of that, yet we're really not taught any of that, because, you know, they want minority groups to stay separate.
Just like you just said, we don't learn that in history books. And anything that does relate to that at all tends to be twisted. And you did just say it, but why is it not talked about anymore? Why do we more often see media coverage when it is still one group victimizing the other group?
Well, this leads to a system of empowering white supremacy. If you educate BIPOC communities on their resistance, on their power, the more likely they are to realize their power and then upset the system and the status quo. So, I mean, there are a lot of reasons as to why, say, the Afro-Asian solidarity essentially really like fell short of, you know, I think that a lot of us expected it to go through it. We expected it to last throughout history, but it did come at a pivotal stop because the U.S. won the Cold War. So, and what I mean by that is that the U.S. really, because it was putting down all of these communist movements around the world, during the Cold War, the U.S. was really afraid of communists taking over the planet. And so they put down a lot of independence movements. So, there was supposed to be a second Bandung conference, but the U.S., the CIA, they essentially assassinated one of the main people leading the Bandung conference. That was the leader of Indonesia at the time, and they assassinated him and put another person in power so that they would follow, you know, the U.S. political agenda. And they did that in every part of the world. And so in every part of the world where there were a lot of independence movements and uprisings, they were shut down because the U.S. essentially won the Cold War. And so that's why a lot of us who were previously colonized were then faced with neocolonialism. So it was hard to really have that resurgence of Afro-Asian solidarity when this point in history, a lot of those countries were taking a dictatorship turn, and the U.S. was really like mitigating everything and like controlling everything. So you see this like dip, but then you see this really beautiful like social justice movement that has arisen in the last few years. The Afro-Asian solidarity that has been forming between like 2014 to now, since the Ferguson movements. And I see this resurgence of Afro-Asian solidarity, and I would hope that it, you know, continues for a long time.
Well, by what you said, I would say that people or kids need to unlearn and relearn this. Unlearn and relearn are two terms that I fell in love with during the Afro-Asian Solidarity panel. So can you share with the listeners what it means and why it is so important that we open ourselves to unlearning and relearning history?
Let unlearn.
Part of the reason I call myself Unlearn the World is because I recognize very early on that a lot of the things that I used, a lot of the information that was given to me in order for me to navigate through the world was wrong and did not serve me in the way that I wanted it to serve me. So before I could acquire new knowledge that would be more helpful, I had to actually remove the conditioning, the bad habits that were created from these kind of antiquated forms of thinking. And this kind of spilled over into my artistry. And I started recognizing that as an artist, my mantra should be my artist name. So I developed the artist name Unlearn the World specifically to break down our societal conditioning. It's an invite to break down what we have grown to accept as normal. And we have to recognize that it's not normal, that it doesn't serve us anymore, and that we need to kind of create our own pathways in things that are conducive to our own development as individuals, whether you're looking for a spiritual enlightenment or you're just looking to get the bag and be a millionaire. There's a way to do it that is specific and conducive to you as a human being and your own experiences, and not what you've been made to believe about race or about ethnicity, about capitalism, about history, about a lot of different things. You know, I was probably your age, maybe a little bit younger, when I realized the myth of Columbus. And I was so literally distraught by the reality of it, right? That it kind of set me on a course of trying to figure out other things. I was almost kind of disenchanted with school up until the eighth grade. And it wasn't until the ninth grade when I was introduced to a performing arts school, where I was introduced to a new alternative kind of education, where I was able to thrive. So I started recognizing very early on in my life that these older, more established ways of thinking or education weren't serving people like myself. And I could only imagine the hundreds of thousands, if not the millions of people around our country and the world who are kind of going crazy, putting square pegs in the round holes, not recognizing that it's a rigged game to begin with, and that in order for us to kind of fit in the way that we need to fit in society, we need to create our own pathway. We need to create our own shape, you know? So that's kind of the mantra I walk with. And my music isn't always rah-rah revolution, but it's more of a chronicling of the things that I go through in my own life that allow me to kind of regress or progress, right? Based on my willingness to unlearn, based on my own experiences and coming to terms with certain things about myself, about my upbringing, about my family, about my community, that we have to recognize, like, this isn't the right way. We've been conditioned to accept these things. We've been conditioned to accept these desires that we have, right? Even the things that we want out of life didn't come from us. They came from magazines and television and radio telling us this is what you want. And when we recognize that we're just kind of a pawn in this larger game, you start to realize that you no longer want to be a pawn. Maybe you want to be a king in your own game. Maybe you want to be a queen in your own game. And then that's when you start creating that game. You can only start creating that game when you're emotionally and mentally detached from the old game. So my entire mantra is the chronicling and the story of how I am personally trying to detach. And that artistry that is coming from that premise, I'm doing it with the hopes that other people are inspired to do the same in their own right.
I can't agree more. Millions of children around the world are having their education corrupted. Not corrupted, maybe a bit much, but corrupted. And schools need to remove curriculum that alters the real perception of history, and instead implement anti-racial curriculum. And one more thing, I loved your metaphors.
Thank you.
What advice do you have for listeners who want to learn the truth and break apart the stereotypes and myths? What are resources that they can trust?
Well, for one, you can book Hip Hop for Change at your school. That's one. But I don't think that there are a lot of resources that schools provide, honestly. I think that any of the unlearning and relearning is going to come from outside. You know, thankfully, the media has evolved in such a way that we can get a lot of our new education from social media. They just have to be like trusted social justice sources. But, you know, there are a lot of Instagram posts that are very social justice oriented, and they are Black. They are produced by Black creators. But in addition to that, I would say that, you know, just research on your own. Like, one of the biggest parts of being an ally is doing the work, you know, putting in the time to research, putting in the time to, you know, find credible sources online, and really not falling into the trap of watching the news or, you know, very, you have to be very careful with what you're consuming, because, you know, I know a lot of Asian Americans really like going to like Next Shark for their information. But, you know, the way that Next Shark and other platforms do promote their news is very racially motivated, or it like positions Black people as opposed to Asian people, instead of positioning the news in a way that like really focuses on white supremacy as the villain. So you really have to be careful on the sources you're looking for and getting information from. That's my advice.
Mr. Richardson?
You know, I want to give credit where credit is due. There are a lot of teachers who are actually trying their best to do the work. There are teachers who recognize the antiquated learning systems that they were taught or that are currently being implemented and are actively creating some sort of resistance movement towards that usual standard education. And they're often met with a lot of confrontation, a lot of you know, problems in their own fields. And these are people who actually love teaching, recognize the importance and the value of being a teacher and being an educator, that are being met with such resistance, right? Because again, white supremacy is a system. There are many people of color who are enforcing white supremacy just as much as there are white people enforcing white supremacy, because it's a system. And it's a system that we've been conditioned to accept and to say that this is kind of the status quo of how things are. So as always, whenever you find individuals who are trying to upset the apple cart, so to speak, or to flip things over and to change things, it's always going to be met with some level of resistance. Right? Like, it's always going to be, that's, you know, Einstein was laughed at, you know, Martin Luther King was villainized and hated in his time and considered a rabble rouser, right? Malcolm X, all the people we look up to now and we love and we idolize, they were rebels in their respective times, because simply because they wanted to have a new approach to the human way of doing things, right? A new approach to humanity and human thinking. So there are people, actual educators now trying to do the work. These are people who, regardless of color, are allies in our movement. These are the ones who are emailing us and giving us a call and saying, hey, can you come into my school and let's procure some money through grants, or I have a whole pool of money to bring you into the school and really shift things in here and have an impact. And we welcome them. We want to invite them in. We want to continue to work with all of you all. You know, and we want to serve as one of those beacons of hope or beacons of resistance for people to know that we are a community resource that is geared in resistance, that is geared in social justice, and is geared in preserving the true legacy and spirit of hip hop culture.
Oh, once again, I'm going to bring it up. Your metaphors are amazing. But to all my listeners, let's keep what you guys have said in mind as we go about our everyday lives. Now, I wanna make sure we have a chance to talk about the fundraisers for the Hip Hop for Change Youth Studio. What are your goals and missions, and how can people like us or like me help?
By continuing to be you, to be honest with you, right? Like, this podcast is exactly the kind of thing that we have in mind for the studio, not only bringing in recording artists who need access to a recording studio to express themselves and to put together projects and to work with artists, mentors and industry professionals and learn. But then aside from artistry, people who wanna come in and just be part of the movement, people who wanna come in and be part of hip hop. They may not rap, they may not make a beat, but they still know how to put together an artist press kit, or they may want to learn how to promote an artist and be behind the scenes. Maybe they love the culture so much, like you, they want to create a podcast for themselves where they're interviewing artists, activists, and educators, and giving them a platform for them to speak and to say what's important and what's in their hearts and minds. So we want to create this space where all of these things are possible, and we want to celebrate and encourage young people to be part of this, right? I think we fail ourselves as a community if hip-hop is only held in the hands of the people who are older. The quote-unquote OGs need to be able to know when and where to yield the space and the floor to young people who have the same kind of motivations and the same kind of intentions. They may have a different approach of doing it, but that's not to say that they're not going to shift things in a way that may be more powerful for the movement, right? So people in my generation need to recognize our role as quote unquote young OGs and give the floor to people like Stephanie, who's just coming out of college and has all this fire in her belly to do good. And Stephanie, with the exception of very few times, don't rap a verse in her life, but she's dope. She can rap. But that's not what she wants to do. She doesn't wake up in the morning like me thinking about songs. I wake up in the morning wanting to rap, right? Stephanie may wake up in the morning and want to do something else, maybe something fashion related or something cool and dope in terms of our communications department, right? This is her frame of thinking, but it's all filtered through hip hop. It's all filtered through a hip hop understanding, and it's all filtered with the intention of using hip hop as a means to create change. So we need to celebrate young people like Stephanie, young people like yourselves, and artists like myself who are a little bit older and still committed to doing the work, need to kind of know our role in terms of guiding and molding future generations. And I think having a studio that's free for all artists 24 years and under is an amazing space for that. Having a program like Pipeline to Positivity, where we're partnering with juvenile detention centers, alternative high schools, group homes, and bringing those students in and giving them a recording budget so that they can write and record songs, make beats, get a photo shoot, get a video shoot, feel like stars in their own right, and being celebrated for talking about their lives, reclaiming their narratives, giving people something positive and inspirational to listen to. I think those artists need to be celebrated just as much as the young artists out there that are celebrating and glorifying death and destruction.
Thank you for that. I will keep doing what I'm doing, but I want you to know that your work and organizations like Hip Hop for Change has been what's inspiring me to try to make a difference. Now, I'm gonna hit you with the hardest question yet. Oh. Who is your favorite hip-hop artist?
That's not a hard question at all.
Wait. Besides, yeah. I guess. I'm gonna do Marlon's and Marlon's gonna do mine. Yes. Marlon's is Nas. Marlon's is Nas, and his close second is Jay-Z.
Yes, all you right. are 100% correct. And yours is J. Cole.
Yeah.
I would say, I want to say your close second is Kendrick.
Yeah, that's fair. Okay. That's fair too.
Yeah. Cool. So, and again, it speaks to our generations, right? I grew up in the generation where Nas and Jay-Z were the Kendricks and the J. Coles of that generation. So it's one of those full circle moments.
You guys know each other pretty well.
We do. We do.
We go back like car seats. It's good.
Well, for the final question, let's talk about something that we still have the power to change now. What are three or less, but what are some things you would like to see the Biden administration do to help combat systemic inequalities?
One, I would like for all of this symbolic, you know, all of these like symbolic gestures that like really, like, you know, like painting Black Lives Matter on streets and stuff. I would like to see all of those symbolic gestures turned into actual policy instead of, you know, giving Black and Brown people crumbs and these really, these symbolic gestures that don't really do much, and instead writing them into policy that, you know, that actually creates change. That would be my one. Marlon can do two.
For me, it's not about the the people in charge, right? It's, for me, it's not about the Biden administration as much as it's about the people, right? As somebody who was active and awake and outside during the Obama administration, who at the time we all thought was going to change the world, and we were very much disappointed on one level or another, I think the biggest disappointment was in our inability to continue to organize and to continue to hold these leaders accountable and keep their feet to the fire, right? Like, they're only going to move based on the political and social mandate that they're receiving from the people. So if we are organized in our own rights and we are kind of creating fellowship amongst organizations, amongst activists, amongst educators, and we're getting this word out of what we want and how we want it, the status quo, the establishment, has no other choice but to respond and yield to what the people want, right? Like, that's one of the beautiful things about democracy, is that it's the people speaking, but the people have to speak. If the people aren't speaking and they're not speaking loud enough, then they're not going to get heard, right? And in this country, unfortunately, money speaks louder than anything else. But I think that when the people are fully organized, we speak louder than money. We speak louder than the special interests and the industries that are out there that are doing everything they can to quell this kind of resistance movement. So again, it's not that we're outnumbered, we're just out organized, and we need to unlearn and relearn in order to organize, come together, and really shift the paradigms of control that we've been conditioned to accept.
Well, I've been thinking about what you've said to me, all of these questions, and wow, this has been a mind-blowing conversation. What we've been talking about, it's the heart of my passions and what I've been doing for making change. Thank you both so much for making the time to talk to someone like me. Please check out Hip Hop for Change at hiphopforchange.org. And that's it for A Change of the Chance, episode 15. I hope you enjoy learning something from Stephanie and Marlon as much as I did, and I'll see you in the next episode. Thank you!
Thank you. Peace, everyone.